Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
After beating LA, wow. After beating the beating LA put on Atlanta in game three, remember that absurd 15-3 beating? There were a whole lot of Dodger fans who were feeling pretty good about themselves. A little too good, come to find out. Because as well as game three went, game four was an unmitigated disaster. It was a catastrophe. And it was the same catastrophe that Dodger fans have been having for years now. Clayton Kershaw pitches pretty well, but is left in a little bit too long. The bullpen cannot hold a lead, and the bats go silent when it matters most. In other words, wash, rinse, repeat. You can set your watch to it. And that's exactly what happened again last night. After beating the ever-living crap out of Atlanta's Kyle Wright in Game 3, the Dodgers then faced Bryce Wilson. Now, if you're not familiar with Bryce Wilson, it's because you shouldn't be. He had pitched less than 43 innings in his entire Major League career. He hadn't even pitched since September 27th. And yet, Bryce Wilson is out there looking like Cy freaking Young last night. The Dodgers managed one hit against him. One. It was a home run by Edwin Rios. That's it. Six innings. The guy allows one hit. He strikes out five. So while Kershaw takes the loss for the game and does deserve some of the blame for the sixth, he would have had to have been perfect to leave that game with a lead. The Dodgers go from putting up 15 runs in three innings to getting a single hit in the first six and a total of three hits for the entire game. Atlanta, on the other hand, was having that proverbial brawl at the bat rack. And to that question of whether Ronald Acuna Jr. and Marcell Ozuna were going to wake up, the answer was most definitely yes. In the affirmative, Acuna went 2-for-4 with a couple of runs scored. Ozuna went legend. The big man hit into a double play in his first at bat, and then all he did after that was cause damage. Extreme damage. There was this in the fourth.
Here's the guy the Braves got to get going. Monster year this year. That is a blast. Way out of here. This ball game is tied. And a couple of stops along the way around the bases for Marcell Ozuna. He said they had to get him going. That thing got out of here in a blink.
Yeah, that thing is still going. That tied the game at one. And I'm not sure what was more electric. Ozuna's home run, Ozuna's trip around the bases, or Acuna's celebratory leap. He looked like MJ in his prime on that jump. My man must have had like a 90-inch vert. And then came the sixth. And that's the one that's going to be burned in the memories of Dodger fans for years to come. Because there have been a lot of innings like this over the past few postseasons. Kershaw had been pitching pretty well to that point. He had given up only that one run, and he had thrown just 71 pitches in the first five innings. He set down the last five hitters he had faced, but Acuna reached on the slow ground ball. He went to second on an error, and Dodger fans had to know. I mean, had to know what was going to happen next, and it started with Freddie Freeman.
So Acuna is going to go down to second on the error by Kike Hernandez, and Freeman has a chance to put Atlanta on top for the first time tonight. Hard hit, base hit, and Atlanta will take the lead. Digging around third, Acuna. Digging into second, Freeman. The two switch spots, and it's 2-1 Atlanta here in the sixth.
So on the one hand, it's 2-1, and you're thinking this is manageable. But then again, you know the Dodgers, and they've been here before. And what 2-1 meant was the nightmare was just getting started. You knew how this was going to end. With Kershaw walking off the mound a little bit too late, the bullpen making it a whole lot worse, and the bats not picking them up. And that's exactly how that went, because that's exactly how it always goes with these guys. Let's go to the tape. After the Freeman double, Ozuna stepped in, preparing to get his third look at Kershaw.
3-2 pitch. That's into left center field. Another run. Driven in by Ozuna. Cruising in the second. Another double. It's 3-1 Atlanta on top in the sixth.
Right.
That double by Marcell Ozuna knocks out Clayton Kershaw.
Right. 3-1 Atlanta Dave Roberts comes to get Clayton Kershaw. Now, I know a lot of you are going to want to hang all of this on Kershaw. But before you do, check yourself for a minute. Quick, what is Kershaw's ERA in his last five postseason starts, including last night? What is it? 7, 9.5, 40? No, it's 3.94. 3.94. Now, not nearly as good as he is in the regular season, but not the utter disaster that everybody always makes him out to be. In fact, there are a ton of starting pitchers who would happily sign up for a postseason ERA of 3.94. It's just that Kershaw is so much better in the regular season. And again, while he was in the game, the Dodgers' bats managed all of one hit. Even if he did pitch like regular season Kershaw, he's not winning that game. So while he has to wear some of that, there is a lot of blame to go around. It's not all his fault. Should he have been yanked earlier? Was it a mistake to let Ozuna see him for a third time, especially when you consider how that second at-bat went? Yeah, all right. All right, let's talk about that for a minute. Did you see what the bullpen did after Kershaw did leave? You can kill Dave Roberts for not going to his bullpen earlier, but given the arsonists that were posted up there, can you blame him? Did you see what happened when he ultimately did turn it over to those gas cans? Bruce Dar Gratterall replaced Kershaw. BG entered the game, having not allowed an inherited runner to score in the postseason. He went from that to letting everybody score. He gets a line out from his first batter, then he gives up a single, then an RBI double, then an RBI single, then he left the game. He threw 15 pitches and he gave up 3 runs, plus the one that he inherited from Kershaw. So you're starting to see why Dave Roberts would rather let Kershaw try and work out of it than let his bullpen set the entire stadium on fire. It was 6-1 by the time Gratterall left. And it didn't end there. Victor Gonzalez comes in. He issues a walk and an RBI single. That makes it 7-1. And then finally got a couple of outs. A complete and total disaster. As before, if the bullpen had been able to keep it at 3-1, the Dodgers were not out of that game. You keep it to a 2 or even a 3-run game, and you keep the pressure on the Braves. You force them into tough decisions. You make them use up their important arms in the bullpen. Instead, this crew took a bad situation and made it so much worse. And you take all the pressure off the Braves. You use water to put out a fire, not gasoline. Remember all that talk about how deep and how good that Dodger bullpen was? Remember how their only concern was Kenley Jansen? Because they had that great and deep bullpen. Yeah, well, that bullpen allowed 15 runs in 15 2/3 innings in this series. Man, that's not a bullpen. That's batting practice. And if the Dodger pitchers were looking for the Dodger hitters to bail them out, then they were begging. Mookie Betts, 0-4. Corey Seager, 0-4. Cody Bellinger, 0-3. A lineup loaded with all-stars and MVP candidates, and they couldn't even scratch out a hit. And it's not like that was one bad night either. They were crap offensively in games 1 and 2 as well. Bellinger is hitting .188 for the series. Betts, even worse at .143. The offense that was unstoppable in the regular season has been unstartable in this series. Like, you take out the last 3 innings of Game 2's loss and the first 3 of Game 3's win, and these guys have been horrible. You take out those 6 innings, and they have scored a total of 3 runs in 30 innings. 3 runs total. Meanwhile, Marcell Ozuna continued to square up everything that came his way, and then he did this in the 7th.
Fourth pitcher of the night for the Dodgers, Dylan Floro, and there's one into center. Back at the wall, and it is gone. Ozuna, his 2nd of the night, and the Braves get that run right back.
Right, and then this dude was still pounding in the 8th.
Ozuna has already had a big night. He's going to add to it with a base hit into center. Another run is on the board, and it's a 10-2 ball game here in the
10-2. That made it 10-2 and capped off the complete and total humiliation of the Dodgers. Winning a playoff game 15-3 is impressive, but losing one 10-2 24 hours later in a must-win game with your ace is pretty much amazing. And now they're in a 3-1 hole, staring at the end of the season and a hell of a lot of criticism. They've gone into the tank before, but never like this. Because it was only like 5 minutes ago that we weren't asking, will they win it all, but rather, will they go down as the best Dodgers team ever when they win it all? And now they're one loss away from this question. Is this the biggest implosion and the biggest disappointment ever for this franchise? And if they show up anything like they did last night in Game 5 tonight, then it is a resounding yes. Because right now, this is an absolute unmitigated catastrophe. If you're a business owner, you do not need me to tell you that running a business is rough. You know this, but you might be making it tougher on yourself than necessary. Do not let QuickBooks and spreadsheets slow you down any longer. It is time for you to upgrade to NetSuite. Listen to me. Stop paying for multiple systems that do not give you the information that you need when you need it. Man, ditch the spreadsheets and all that old software that you've outgrown that is so outdated. Upgrade to NetSuite by Oracle. It's the world's number one cloud business system. NetSuite gives you visibility and control over your financials, your HR, your inventory, your e-commerce, and everything you need all in one place instantaneously. So whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in revenue, you need to save time and money, and you can do so with NetSuite. Join the over 21,000 companies that are using and loving NetSuite right now. Let NetSuite show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/Rome. Schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/Rome, netsuite.com/ROME. Is Steelers Corner Steven Nelson. Steve, it's good to have you on the show. How are you?
Hey, man. Thanks for having me. I'm doing great.
Good, good. Hey, listen, I know you're focused on the Browns and that challenge. I'm going to get to that in 1 minute, but I mentioned you had a huge game against Philadelphia. Can you take me back to Sunday first? What was your mindset going into that game, and did you know you had something special in you?
Right, man. Just going into that game, man, that whole week of preparation, man, you know, I just pretty much had a chip on my shoulder. Going into it, man, I was working hard all week. Trying to get the guys to rally, man, and we knew we had a, you know, big time opponent coming in. And you know, I always bet on myself, so I knew, you know, what I was capable of, man, and you know, the chips finally, you know, came through for me.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned you had a chip on your shoulder, and when you look at that secondary, something that you and some of the others have talked about is you all feel like you're underdogs. You all feel like you've got a collective chip on your shoulder. Where does that attitude come from, and then how powerful is that when you've got a bunch of guys in that same secondary that have that mentality?
Right. And that mentality is just something that, you know, the Steelers defense has had historically. You know, just, you know, go out there and, you know, make big plays and, you know, all rally to the ball, you know, that same camaraderie like you've seen on the past Steelers defenses, man. You know, it's just something that, you know, organizations that, you know, that's instilled in us. And to answer your question, man, about, you know, everybody in the secondary with that net, you know, to be great, you know, and feel like underdog. I think that's special, you know, to have everybody on the same page and, you know, want to, you know, be a playmaker each and every game.
Steven Nelson joining us. You know, the people who know, however, as an example, Pro Football Focus had you as a top 10 cornerback in the NFL last season, and your numbers stack up really well against the other guys who are Pro Bowlers. So do you feel like you're starting to get the respect that you deserve, or do you feel like people are still sleeping on you?
Yeah, people still sleeping on me, man. But, you know, it just comes with the territory. You know, I haven't had enough splash plays. And I recognize that, and it seems like, you know, that's what it's about. You know, you don't get splash plays, and you don't get the recognition, you know. So, you know, that was my whole motto coming into this season, was to make a lot more splash plays than I had last season, even though last year, you know, I didn't really give up, you know, too much. But, you know, when it all counts, I mean, at the end, when it comes to, you know, the stats and all that kind of stuff, you know, they look at the splash plays over everything.
See, the thing about that is, though, you can't make those plays. You can't make those splash plays if they're not testing you. For instance, last season, you didn't get a whole lot of chances for interceptions because teams were not going your way. Instead, it was Joe Hayden who got the INTs. So teams, if they're not throwing at you, it's a sign of respect. but is there a part of you that wants to say, hey, man, can you test me? I can't make a play if you don't come at me.
Yeah, man. It's just part of the game, man. You know, you just got to, you know, be patient and wait your turn, man. That's what I learned in this league, man. You know, things don't, you know, happen when you want them to. They just kind of happen, you know, as time goes on. You know, like last week, I got two interceptions. You know, I went into a game, you know, I always wanted to make a big play, but it's like I'm not going to beat myself up about it, you know, to the point where if I don't make a big play, you know, I get down on myself. You know, you just got to, you know, certain things have to just come to you, you know what I mean?
Exactly, right? You can't force it. You can't force that kind of thing. You have to wait for it to come to you. Steven Nelson joining us. You know, when you signed with Pittsburgh, you touched on this. There's this great, great Steeler tradition, especially defensively. Over the years when I've done this, Steve, I've talked to so many guys, and they all talk about it. When you signed with Pittsburgh as a free agent in 2019, what was it about the opportunity there that appealed to you so much? Why did you like that fit?
Man, I was Steelers fan just because of the defense. I always like, you know, the way they play, their physicality on the defensive side of the ball. And just also, you know, just looking at, you know, what they had, you know, the type of talent they had. You know, we don't even got to talk about it. We got a lot of great guys up front rushing. You know, we got great guys in the secondary. So, you know, I just saw like a good fit for me to come in and, you know, play a role in the defense.
You know, it's one thing for you to see the fit. It's another for them to approach you the way they did. And what I mean by that is this is not a franchise that normally goes out and makes big signings in free agency. So what did it mean to you that they targeted you and they made you a big offer?
It meant a lot, man. You know, my agent kind of explained that, and I was actually, you know, surprised. Like, wow, I don't really know the history of stuff like that. You know, so, you know, I'm just very blessed and you know, fortunate, you know, these guys, you know, saw, you know, something that in me could come out and help this team.
Steven Nelson joining me for another moment or so. And then, of course, you got the Browns coming to your place on Sunday. That is a big game. As you look at the film and you get ready for that game, what is the number one key to slowing them down?
Definitely stopping the run. They do that very well. They got, you know, a plethora of good running backs on the offensive side of the ball, man. So, definitely stopping that run game, you know, can be good for us.
Troy Reeder is my guest. Troy, it's great to have you on. How are you?
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it. I'm doing well.
Good, good. Good to have you, Troy. So you got that first start of the season on Sunday. And as I mentioned, you showed up in a huge way. You've talked about how you prepare every single week like you're going to have a big role. So when the opportunity finally does come, you're ready. Knowing all of that, what kind of thoughts were you having when you took the field on Sunday?
It was exciting. I'm from the East Coast, about 2 hours from D.C., so kind of felt like I was back around home. No fans in the stands, but felt the presence of home. And, you know, just to go out and be a big contributor for a really good team win was really exciting.
Troy Reeder, my guest. Now, Troy, you had 3 sacks in that game, but afterwards, we were really quick to point out that it was the defensive line and the pass rushers in front of you who really deserve much of the credit. Lay that out for me. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, football is the ultimate team game, and you know, when you have guys on our D line like Aaron Donald, Leonard Floyd, Michael Brockers, guys that have been rushing the passer and having a lot of success doing it for years. You know, they obviously draw a lot of attention, and even so, Aaron had a huge game. But, you know, when I'm called upon to be part of that rush plan, I also need to play up to their standard, and was able to capitalize on some plays that I came free.
Rams linebacker Troy Reeder, my guest. I mean, Troy, the fact is there have been a lot of amazing players, a lot of great players in that league who have never had a 3-sack game. I'm curious, when you're in the middle of a game like that, does it feel different? I mean, does the game feel slower than normal or like you're seeing things happen as they develop, or does it feel like a regular game at regular speed except for 3 sacks?
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you start getting in the flow of the game, it just starts to slow down more and more as the game goes on. You start to get a good feel of what the offense is doing and even what your D coordinator is kind of feeling out himself and where the game is going from that perspective. But, Yeah, you know, it was pretty funny. I didn't realize I had three until I was in the locker room after the game.
Really?
One of the sacks was right at the line of scrimmage, and I didn't know they counted it as a sack. It was actually the first one. So until I was in the locker room, I thought I had two, which obviously I was ecstatic about. But then when I heard I had three, I thought that was pretty funny. We didn't even realize it on the field.
That is pretty funny. You had yourself a day. Troy Reader joining us. One of the things that came out of it also, the lingo green dogging or green dog blitzing. For those who do not know, what does that mean? And then how effective can that be in a game?
Yeah, a green dog blitz is essentially when you're covering the running back or a tight end or any player, and that player blocks or doesn't release into a pass pattern, you can add on to the blitz. And you become an extra blitzer when your guy blocks.
We're talking to Troy Reader, now you know. So, Troy, you mentioned Aaron Donald. Everybody knows about Aaron Donald, but as a linebacker, how good is the entire defensive line in front of you?
They're great. Obviously, Aaron gets a ton of attention, and rightfully so, but you know, Michael Brockers has been doing it for 9 years. I have a ton of respect for him, and you know, we thought he was moving on, and we ended up getting him back this year, which was great. From a leadership and player standpoint, got some good edge guys, and you know, we're deep at that position, which lets our guys stay fresh. And you know, they're a really fun group to play with, practice with, and you know, they have a really good relationship with each other, and it's fun to watch games like last week where everybody's kind of hitting on all cylinders and having a lot of success as they have all season.
Rams linebacker Troy Reader is joining us. And Troy, you made the point too, quote, it's hard not to take Aaron for granted. Some of the stuff he does, people come to expect from him. I mean, it's so true, right? The guy plays at an extraordinary level, an elite level every single week. It's like he does things you've never seen before every single week. I mean, even as a peer and a fellow pro, when you watch this guy, does he do things that even blow your mind?
Blow our minds. You know, it is crazy, whether it's a walkthrough or practice, games. Obviously, the whole nation gets to see the games. But, you know, what he does every single day, it is pretty darn impressive. And, you know, I'm thankful I get to witness it. And I think it makes all our teammates better just seeing how hard he works in practice and the things he does in practice. And by no surprise, it shows up in the game. And that's why he's been a human highlight reel for the last several seasons. And when you have a guy like that who does work so hard and has success on the field, and then you're bringing in young players and see that, and that it doesn't just happen on Sundays. I mean, that's the kind of guy you build your franchise around.
Troy Reader is joining us. You know, Troy, I've talked to a lot of players on this show, so I think people listening understand that there are guys that slip through the cracks. There are guys who are undrafted. There are guys who make it in the league who are not drafted, but there are a lot that don't. So coming in as an undrafted player, what was your mental and physical approach to proving yourself and earning a spot on that team, and what was your process?
You know, I know there's things in life you can control and things that you can't. I just thought that I was a good enough player to play in this league and believed it. I have a really good support base in my family, and when I got here, received great coaching that has helped me develop. So, you know, I think just being able to control what you can control, and a lot of times that's just doing all the little things right, the effort, the hustle. And then as you learn the defense and start to find a role and the pieces fall into place. But, you know, I tell every rookie, whether they're a first or second round pick or undrafted, you know, you got to come in ready to compete. I mean, it's a 90-man roster to start camp, and they got to get it down to 53.
We were talking to Troy Reader. They got to get it down to 53. And I know you've talked in the past about a moment from one of the last days of OTAs last year when they were running that two-minute drill, and you were thrown in there against the first-team offense, and you were relaying all the calls to the rest of the defense. What was that moment like for you? And was that the time when you realized, man, I know I can do this. I do belong here.
Sorry, can you repeat that? I lost you for a second.
Yeah, I was saying that at that one of the last days of OTAs last year when you were running, or they were running the two-minute drill, and you were thrown in against the first-team offense, and you had to relay all the calls to the rest of the defense. I'm curious what that moment was like, and was there a sense of, hey, listen, I know that I can do this on this level?
Yeah, I think that was huge for me before having about a month off before camp, and you know, just having the confidence to send me out there with a lot of really good guys and really having to run the show. And obviously there was a lot to improve on, but, you know, just the fact that I felt like I faced one of the toughest situations in football, being in command of a two-minute drill against one of the most high-powered offenses in the league, heading into that summer in camp, you know, it just gave me that extra confidence that, you know, I can play in this league and I'm going to come back in August and make this team.
So one last thought, Troy, you mentioned that the win against Washington was key because you're an East Coast guy. You did grow up in Delaware. I'm curious, what's it been like to make the transition from the East Coast to the West Coast, and how do you like life out here?
You know, I love the weather.
Right?
It's hard to beat Southern California, I'll tell you that. I love that it gives my family and friends a really cool place to come out and visit. Tons of stuff to do. Obviously, we're in a weird time right now where a lot of that stuff is pretty shut down. But you know, it's been nice. You know, I like it out here. I've really enjoyed myself, and you know, I spend a little time on the East and West Coast, but definitely love it out here.
Hey, listen, are you craving some protein after a good workout? Don't make a shake or eat a bar. Instead, grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Why? Why Old Trapper? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty, it's tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire. And Old Trapper is a family-owned business that takes smoked beef very seriously. You can taste it in every single bite. Like, who wants dried out, tough beef in a bag? Nobody. It's like eating a shoe. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal. It comes in four amazing flavors. Old Fashioned, which is sweetened with a touch of brown sugar goodness, teriyaki, peppered, and hot and spicy for those of you who want to shake things up. Next time you want to grab a great protein and energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper beef jerky. Be sure to look for Old Trapper. It's in the Clearview bag. That way you can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, clones, ask for it by name, because no other beef jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Of Shamrock Farms Rockin' Protein, I'm talking about Richard Jefferson. Richard, good to have you on. How are you?
I'm great. I have a lot of jobs now that you mentioned. Jeez, I got...
Good for you, dude. You do have a lot of jobs. Are you still there, Richard? I lost you for a minute.
Yes, I'm still
okay,
here.
Okay, good. Yeah, man. So you do have a lot of jobs. Yeah. That speaks very, very well of you. What's it like having all those jobs and all those platforms?
Honestly, you know what? So the Detox Podcast was, I had some good friends, Geeter and Alex Curry and Matt Leinart, and they invited me on their podcast, and then I never left. This was during the summer. And then I went back to my team, the Cavs, after we won, and I decided to start my own podcast. So that's how the road tripping thing got started. And then I was bored, so I started the Sports Gap. So it's just one of those things. You know this, Jim, and I've always been, you know, watched you and grew up watching you. Like, it's all about how hard you work and you finding opportunities and continuing to grind. I saw you would fly out to do a segment on CBS football. And it was just like, dude, you work hard. That's what you're going to do. The people that survive in this industry are the ones that are constantly working and trying to improve and putting in the time and the effort.
My man, I appreciate that, Richard. Thank you very much for saying so. And you do understand that. You've always understood that. And I'm glad you mentioned Geeter. Geeter is one of my favorite guys ever. You and Chris McGee were on the Detox Podcast telling a story about you doing a TV hit when LeBron walked by. What happened in that moment, and what did LeBron call you?
Am I allowed to say that? I don't know what the written. Okay.
No, we got to clean up exactly what he called you, but give me a sense of what he called you.
He called me a bald MF-er. And it was funny because when you're in this in the bubble and you're in this space, like, you have like a camera and a boom mic that you're not holding for the people at home, and you have to wear a mask. So all of a sudden he walks kind of behind that mic and says it while I'm on live television. So I don't know that the boom mic picks it up until after I hear it. But I don't know, everyone else at home heard it. And that's when I get off. I'm getting texts from all sorts of people. It's like, yo, LeBron just said, and I was like, man, do you see how people treat me? Do you see how, like, these are people that I consider friends, and they are just making my job very, very hard. Now, if I would have said something crazy and be like, you know, and I would have responded, then I would have lost my job. Do you see how these people treat us?
No, I understand this, Richard. I think that also you already understand this, but I think it's something that bears repeating. When you just said to me, am I allowed to say that? Because you do so many different things for so many different platforms, always remember the room, right? Like, if you do enough broadcasting the way you do, you might forget where you are. Am I on ESPN? Am I doing a podcast? Is it terrestrial radio? You have to be so careful, because if you misstep once and you forget what the room is, that could be the end.
Oh, very, very quickly. And, you know, I'll give a shout out to my guy, Ian Eagle, who does so much football stuff. And when I first started calling games with him, he taught me so, so much, because when you do a podcast, it's like there can't be dead air, very similar to radio. You can't be dead air. But when you're calling a basketball game, it's all about, you know, allowing for the crowd noise and the sneakers squeaking and the ball bouncing and allowing for that to enter in the room. And I will say this, like, the one thing that I've learned is, and people don't understand this about media that you do, every single platform has a different cadence and style of talking. Doesn't matter if it's radio, if it's calling a game, if it's an analyst on different shows, whether it's First Take or whatever, everything has a different cadence and a different setup and a different style. And the people that learn to master that, It is really, truly beautiful to watch if you know what you're looking for.
It's extremely well said. Richard Jefferson is joining us. He's appearing courtesy of Shamrock Farms Rockin' Protein, which we'll get to in a minute. I mean, obviously, Richard, your basketball IQ was off the charts. You played the game at a really high level for a really long time. So I'm curious, how special is LeBron's basketball IQ, and then how does that show up on the court?
Well, it's so funny. You know, I was telling this to, you know, on a Detox podcast. I said, it's like, look, I can speak at basketball and communicate basketball at a very high basketball IQ level. But guys like Rondo and Bron, they play and understand the game at a very, very high basketball level that I honestly was not at. And very few people, I think, in their careers ever reached that. You know, in my career, I think playing with like Jason Kidd, Tim Duncan, Greg Popovich, there are just certain people that just, they're what, Luka Doncic is the one that I've seen recently that, like, oh, he's not playing the same game as everybody else. And, you know, for a guy like Bron, I think, you know, even he said it. He said the guy at 35 would destroy the 25-year-old Bron, just because he's continued to improve his basketball IQ and study games and study the history and study player tendencies, coaching tendencies. You know, those are things that, you know, I think are part of the reason why he's been, you know, at the top for so long, because it's not just about physical. It's about how you handle the mental aspects of the game, because the game's always changing.
We're talking to Richard Jefferson. Richard, I'm curious, like, the Clippers, meanwhile, I mean, I can go on and on about the Lakers and all the great things that they accomplished in the postseason and in the bubble. And then you have the Clippers, like, take Kawhi Leonard, a 2-time finals MVP, and there was a lot of talk about whether or not he was, in fact, the best player in the league. Does the collapse against the Nuggets make you see him in a different light at all?
I wouldn't say a different light. I think when people have a great run like Kawhi did have, I think a lot of times we can elevate somebody to a place that rightfully so they should be on, but is that their place full time? Like when people are like, oh, Kawhi could be the first one to win finals MVP for, you know, 3 years in a row. And it's like, well, Kawhi wasn't even an all-star the first time he won finals MVP, right? So you have to understand that, like, there's levels to consistent greatness. And, you know, what he did in Toronto was amazing, but I think there's still a lot of work for him and his teammates to do. And I don't think that they should be destroyed for how they played in that fourth quarter and on the 3-1. But I think in their first year, you're going to have some hiccups, and you got to learn how to pick that up, because we do love to see how teams respond and players respond to down moments.
So what do you think about Ty Lue? You played for Ty Lue. How do you think that fit works? Do you like the fit, and how do you think those players, that group, will respond to Ty Lue?
I think Ty Lue is a great, great fit, and I think I'm glad that he got the deal that he deserved. This is a man that, you know, went to multiple finals, you know, coached, you know, in the NBA championship and won one. You know, he didn't deserve a 3-year deal. And look, I stand by this. If T. Lou would have taken the job, I believe that they would have won a championship also, because I think T. Lou and Frank Vogel, I think these guys both would have been great for the job of coaching the Lakers. And think about how hard that was for T. Lou to turn down the Laker job and to pair up with Bron, who he had a great relationship, and Anthony Davis. And, you know, but there was just things about the job that he wasn't going to concede. And, you know, one of the things I heard a long time ago is set your price and live your life. Right. And he set his price and the Lakers weren't willing to meet that price. And so he lived his life. And now he has an opportunity to coach a great team in Los Angeles that with players that he has a great relationship with.
I think that's a great, great line. Set your price and live your life. Which, let me ask you really quickly before I talk to you about Rockin' Protein. You had a great NBA career. You've had a fascinating NBA career. I could go on and on and ask you anecdotally about that. But you're also a member of that great Arizona Wildcat family. Tommy Tolbert's one of my best friends ever. There are so many interesting players and figures and characters that came out of that program. What's it like to be a part of that Wildcat family?
You know what? It's just great. And, you know, with the passing of Lute Olson and with, you know, you see how many players, like we did a Zoom call, which obviously just doesn't do someone that has that type of greatness. It doesn't do them any type of respect. But just to get on that Zoom call and see players that he coached from the 80s, and I mean the 70s and the 90s and the 2000s, and just watch so many emotional guys, you know, it was such a huge family that this man cultivated and created everywhere he went. He was like your grandfather, but he was a brilliant basketball mind. And, you know, even to this day, you look at his impact. You have Andre Iguodala, you have, Steve Kerr, you have so many guys on television that are still, Luke Walton, who is the head coach for the Sacramento Kings. You're just, his fingerprints are still on this game in a very, very heavy way. And he literally retired like 15 years ago.
And not only that, but never, ever forget that what he inherited and what he started with and what that program was when he first got there and what he built it into. Now, Richard, one of the things I'm always, always fascinated with is athletes and the way they approach their post-career physically in terms of nutrition and the way they get after it. I mean, some guys go as hard as ever. It's a lifestyle. Others say, you know what? I kind of earned this. I don't want that life. I don't want to do that anymore. You're working with Shamrock Farms Rockin' Protein. How did that relationship come to be? And what do you like about their protein?
Well, you know what I love about their protein is, one, I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, and I used to see their signs all the time. I used to drive by, you know, their sign on my way to practice every single day. So to be a local kid and to see, have a company that you always drank growing up. And for me, it's like, I want to keep working out. I have a 3-year-old and I have a 5-year-old, and, you know, I love running around. I live in Hermosa Beach. I'm constantly working out. It's just part of like my lifestyle. It's some of the things that keeps me sane. And so to have a partnership with something that you've already drank, I've always been a fan of, and I really, really enjoy the product. Even now, I just got done working out, and you know, anybody that works out knows you got to get your protein in, you know, 30 minutes before, after your workout's in. So to be able to grab something that quick, that's delicious, that's easy, and it's something that, you know, you grew up, there's a nostalgia there for me. So, you know, I'm so excited about the partnership. And, you know, I try and promote healthy living, especially because athletes go through so much when they retire. They always say athletes die twice. And, you know, it's once when you retire and then once in real, you know, in life. But, you know, there can be that moment there. And I think continuing to work out, continuing to get up and push your body and push your brain, I think it does wonders for you.
But then again, I've done this a long, long time. Then again, it is my name on the marquee. Then again, it is my show. Then again, what are they going to do? Take me out of the Hall of Fame? Watch this. Apparently, you're all ready for it anyway. At Hitman Canadian tweets, "Rattiest cities? Let me know. I've got some buddies coming over for dinner. Thanks, IRA." Mailman Casey tweets, "Huntington Beach may not be the rattiest city in the U.S., but the biggest rat I know lives there. Unwar Narkbra."
Bra.
Narc.
Bra.
Narc.
Bra.
Narc.
Bra.
Narc.
Bra.
Rat.
Bra.
Narc. Rat.
Bra. Bra.
Snitch. Narc.
Bra.
Rat.
Bra.
Eric.
Bra.
Eric Narc.
Bra.
All right, so, I mean, I hate to even go here. It seems pretty early in the day to do so, however, and I can't believe that I'm going to say this, but it has been a very, very big year in this here jungle for rats. That, of course, is the band Rat with two T's. That's one of the ultimate buzzwords on this program. Rat with one T. The band has two T's. I don't really know the genesis or the origin of that band and why they felt like they needed two T's. I mean, why not have three? That doesn't look right. The artwork's not right. Just hang another T on there. I mean, nobody named their band Dog with two G's. At least they didn't flip that R around like corn. Anyway, it is one of the ultimate buzzwords on this show, rat. And many of you know why that is, but many of you do not. And if you want to talk about origin, it goes all the way back to the 1990s when we didn't have tweets. We didn't even have email. Back then, it was just a fax machine, literally a fax machine. And back in the day, when we had a really hot topic, you know, like Bobby Knight, Pete Rose, and this thing that I'm about to get to, a really good day, we could get several hundred faxes. Like the record was like 374 faxes in one day, and they'd come through one at a time. But there was never a fax like the one Gaucho Bill sent me. I'm not sure of the exact year. Early 90s? Gaucho Bill sends me a fax that reads in part, quote, "All I've seen in the local fish wrap lately are pictures of Monica Seles's rodent face contorting in a most heinous fashion as she prepares to pound the ball back at her horrified human opponent. Her mouth is agape, exposing her beaver-like chompers, while her beady black eyes are riveted on the ball. It's as though the rat girl thinks it's not a tennis ball she's striking, but a cheese ball. And the winner gets all she can eat." Yeah, I mean, that may be somewhat amusing to you right now, but I'm here to tell you that when that fax came through, I was crying. Like, I couldn't even read it on the air. I could not get it out. And I may be mistaken, but I think that's actually how the Rat family started, with that actual fax. And the staying power of that fax cannot be understated, because it paved the way to the very unfortunate, very regrettable, but extremely unforgettable Rat family, which I've been trying to scrub from the internet ever since. But as we all know, the internet is in ink. You can't scrub it. You can't. I mean, I'd like to live in a world where that never happened. You all want to live in a world, however, where it's still a thing every single day. Like, I used to literally have conversations like this with professional athletes back in the day about that particular family. Listen to this. This is a conversation I had with Mark Grace about the family in 1996.
Are you dialed into the Rat family?
No, I'm not.
We have a new Rat family in the jungle. Here are the goals for this year for Mark Grace. 100 runs batted in, 20 home runs, 330, gold glove, all-star appearance, and one glossary entry in the Rat family.
And one glossary. I'll tell you what, Romy, my next jungle adventure, I'm going to have someone for an addition to the Rat family for you. Romy, go hit on some fat chicks and bug off, all right?
This was the kind of conversation that we would have on this show. That was 1996. Me and all-star Mark Grace, and me explaining to him what the Rat family was and his responsibility to add to it. So whenever any kind of story comes up that even references a rat, you clones are all over it. Like Selish on a cheese ball, as Gaucho Bill would say. So 2020 has been a big, big year for the jungle in terms of rats. The aforementioned Canadian hitman pointed this out. There was Silk Bra going rat bra.
Bra.
With his tweet to the Huntington Beach Police Department. There was the San Antonio Zoo running a Valentine's Day promo where you could name a cockroach after your ex and then watch them feed it to a rat on a live stream. There was the rat hotline for the NBA bubble. There was the discovery that the St. Louis Cardinals had a utility man, Brad Miller, and his nickname is Rat. There was that giant lying rat, Charles E. Cheese, slinging cardboard pizza under the alias Pasquale's just to survive the pandemic. You know, that gigantic rat. All of these stories have been covered all right here because you all love rats and you all love the jungle rat family. So naturally, when a list came out this week of America's rattiest towns, you were all up in my mentions demanding a take. First, there is nothing lazier than list radio. It's even lazier than rat radio. Secondly, why would I run down a list of the rattiest cities in America? Who cares? Who wants to know that? Well, apparently Channel 13 in Sacramento does. Channel 13 in Sacramento is all over it. Not only that, but they seem kind of proud of the fact that they're working their way up the rat list.
Sacramento just moved up the list of rattiest cities in the United States. This study is from Orkin, based on the rankings of number of rodent treatments it conducted over the past year. Sacramento landed at 36th on this list, moving up five spots from the year before. A pair of California cities actually made the top five in order. Those are Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, Washington, D.C., and San Francisco.
Slow news day? Come on, man. Who made the decision in the newsroom to flaunt moving up five spots on the list from 41 to 36? I mean, we're not exactly... Can I get my music, please? Thank you, Alvin. Don't be a rat. We're not exactly talking about the NFL power rankings here. We're talking about the rattiest cities in America. And I'm a big Sacramento fan, but Cowtown seems pretty stoked to be moving up in the world as Rat Town. Now, personally, I am a little put off as a native Californian that there are so many California cities that are so freaking ratty. Like, I no longer live in L.A., but I was born in L.A. L.A. is number two ahead of New York. How the hell is that possible? I've been to New York. The rats operate the subways in that city. But apparently the Golden State is turning into the Rodent State. We're on that list four times. And no, this is not an invitation to remind me that Corey Pavin was born in California. I know. Nor do I know what his favorite cheese is. I don't care. Nor do you need to point out that Gary Gaetti played for the Angels at one point. I'm well aware of that. This is a current list of actual rats, not an old list of people who allegedly look like rats. I can't be more clear about that. This is an actual current list of real rats, not a totally outdated list of people who you think look like rats. So don't go trying to wedge in any references that bring me down to the hell in which you love to live in. Remember, this list is based on how many rat treatments that the company Orkin does every single year. You know what? It's actually an indictment on that company, Orkin. Come on, man. Up your poison game, Orkin. Knock these rats out my state so I don't have to listen to local news reports about moving up the rat list. Man, and how bad is it where you live if that's something you want to show off about? Damn, we're climbing that thing. Look how much higher we are on the list of rats this year than last year. You know how many more rats? You know how many more rats we have now than we did a year ago at this time? Man, we got to break the top 20. We got to break the top 20. The one, the only flight deck, James Kelly. What's up, Head?
Jim, I think I'd rather talk about Gaucho Bill and Zane Smith and the rat family more than gambling right now.
Zane Smith, I'd forgotten about him. Are there any others that you want to mention from the family that I left out besides Zane Smith?
A famous college basketball coach, but I won't go there.
Don't. Please don't. Please don't. All right, so I'm making an appearance on the NFL on CBS this Sunday. One of my topics for that show, Big Head, is the Pack versus the Bucks, Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady. And I've got thoughts on that matchup myself and what that means. You, of course, though, are coming at it from a totally different angle. Packers -1 at Tampa. Rarely do you ever see Tom Brady as a dog at home, but he is in this case. Who do you like and why?
So rare is right on that, Jim. And when Brady is at home dog, he's actually 9-1 against the spread as the home dog. But I'm going to hit the pack here, and I'm going to give up a point. I'm going to Aaron Rodgers, man. He's coming off a bye, and coming off a bye, he's actually the league's most profitable quarterback. He's 8-2-1 with an extra week of rest in the regular season for his career. And this year, he's thrown for 13 touchdowns, no interceptions. He's playing the best ball of his life, over 300 yards a game. Now, that's how you attack this Bucs D, too. And I still think they could probably run a little bit against this Bucs D with Aaron Jones. He's playing great ball, and the Bucs are now missing Vita Vea, which is a massive, massive loss. I think Brady still puts up some points for the Packers. He should have his weapons back, but Aaron Rodgers also has his weapons back. And if this game was played in the playoffs, I might change my mind. I still think the Bucs have a Super Bowl talent, but the injury with Vea might change that in the long run. I'm riding the Packers on Sunday. They are a perfect 4-0 against the spread, the only perfect team in the NFL, and I think they get 5-0. Packers minus 1.
Are you sure you don't want to spend five more minutes on that game?
Oh, dude, it's a great game. It's better than the other one.
I can tell. All right, listen, I've got thoughts on that too, but I'm going to hold them until Sunday when I appear on the NFL on CBS. But for right here and right now, you've got the big head. Packers minus 1. All right, now Vikings v. Falcons. James, pretty ugly-looking game, but this ain't a beauty contest. It's business. It's just entertainment. And they are going to play, and there is going to be a line. In fact, that line is Vikings minus 3.5. The Falcons cleaned house, firing their coach, firing their GM. How do you think the Falcons are going to respond on the field?
I don't think they will at all. I'm going to lay the 3.5 and take the home team Vikings here, Jim. The Falcons' strength is their passing offense. And you'd think they'd expose the Vikings' young corners, but they didn't look good against Carolina without Julio Jones. And I'd be surprised if Julio goes this week with his hammy. And this team is going for
a retail. What are you, a doctor now?
Fail clown.
The Falcons' secondary is also beat to hell, and the Vikings have two wideouts in Adam Thielen and Justin Jefferson that they should expose them there. And plus, the Vikings' run game is unstoppable right now. They don't have Dalvin Cook, but it doesn't really matter. It's a plug-and-play right now. Alexander Mattison should go off. They ran him for over 200 yards against Seattle in that run defense. And this stat, too, Mike Zimmer, as a non-divisional home favorite, is 19-4-1 against the spread. I like the Vikings minus 3.5 at home. Hit the Vikings.
Dude, who are you, Rain Man? Hey, what time is Wapner on? How many matches in that matchbox? Dude, you're incredible. All right, so it's a good thing that that's not a beauty contest and that you've taken all the emotion out of it. Why else would you give a damn, Flight Deck, about Detroit and Jacksonville? But I know you do. Lions are minus 3 at Jacksonville. Who you got there, and why do you like that game?
Well, I like it because Jacksonville is so bad. I mean, I'm not going to watch it probably, but I can still make fake money off of it, Jim.
No, we do this for entertainment purposes only, remember?
That's right. That's why it's fake. So I'm going to take the team who has won 2 games of their last 17 in the Lions, minus 3 at Jacksonville. The Jags defense is banged up, man. They're not very good. When they're healthy, the offseason changes when they got rid of all that talent is really rearing its ugly head. Their pass D is allowing the league's 31st worst passer rating. They allowed over 75.8% of their passes against opposing quarterbacks. Deshaun Watson lit them up. Matthew Stafford is better than everybody thinks he is, and so is Kenny Galladay. Galladay is very, very good, and this
Watson?
Team has played much better with him in the lineup.
Galladay?
Expect both of them to go off. Minus 3.5 Lions.
All right, so let me give you a matchup, Deck, that I think is sort of interesting, actually. The Bears plus 2 at the Panthers. I think Matt Rhule is doing an amazing job with the Panthers. And while I don't understand why, I'm also fascinated in your fascination with all things the Chicago Bears. Clarify that spread for me. What is it, and who do you have?
So it's 2 right now, but I hit this on Sunday at plus 3 for the Bears. Dude, the Matt Rhule thing is real. The Teddy Bridgewater thing is, he might be the best quarterback against the spread ever. And stats might back that up, actually. But I am going Chicago.
That's a great line right there. Is that true? What are the numbers? He's the best quarterback against the spread ever?
Negative
Yeah, in the Super Bowl era, I believe. I don't know. I got the exact one, but it, I mean, he last year for the Saints, and I mean, the guy covers at a high rate against the spread. So,
so what do you like in that game? Who do you like?
Yeah, I like Chicago. Their pass defense is one of the league's best, and Khalil Mack right now is he's heating up, dude.
Dude, how about this? Ritt just weighed in, and maybe you heard Ritt. He had his own segment earlier this week.
Game on.
Ritt just weighed in and says that Bridgewater is 30-9 against the spread.
Bring it on.
See, there you go. At least he didn't kill Teddy Bridgewater like he did Tom Hanks, but, I mean, cool.
James Kelly's so cool.
Tom Hanks went belly up, Ritt, as well. So.
All right, so the biggest game. Well done, Head. Well done. Biggest game of the college football season might be tomorrow. Number 2, Bama, going up against number 3, Georgia. Really quickly, I want your thoughts. Bama without Nick Saban, what are you doing with that game?
So this has changed now, Jim. It was +6.5 for Georgia earlier in the week. I hit that then. It's changed now to -4.5 for Bama because of the Saban news. I just think the Bulldogs' defense is good. It should slow the Alabama offense, and nobody can stop that offense. I mean, it's damn good with Mac Jones and all the weapons that he's got. But Georgia does have a lot of talent. Without Saban, I'll take the Bulldogs +6.5.
Okay, I like that. Listen, before you go, what about baseball? I know you. I know you, Deck. I know you like to get in and bet in-game, like with the NBA. I know you like to get in and bet in the middle of a series. And I know your plays. I know you're contrarian. I know what you do. Did you try to get a piece of the Dodgers when they were down 2-0?
Well, I looked at it, and I think I had better odds, so I didn't hit it. But right now, Jim, you can get, for all the Dodger fans out there that still believe, you could get +475 for them to win the World Series right now.
Would you?
Still believe.
Would you?
If I didn't know the closer for the other team, yes, I would probably hit that.
Okay, so now the closer for the other team, of course, is Mark Melancon. Dude, tell the story again. You really coached this guy in Little League?
Yeah, man. Lifelong friends. Carnation Bowl champions, 1998. He was a quarterback.
Yeah, but you coached him in baseball, though, not football.
Nah, football. Yeah, he quit after that and went to baseball. Maybe I didn't have a very good effect on him, but...
And here we go.
Wow, folks.
What you're seeing and hearing is not a mistake.
Back for more.
I'm back.
Back for all that is good.
The king is back.
Welcome to the jungle. My name is Jim Rome. A very good Monday to you. Laker fan, how y'all living? After stumbling through the desert 10 long years searching for another championship, now you've got one. How does that feel?
Yeah! The Lakers are putting a number on the
and
Heat.
Don't be putting an asterisk on this either. Not only was that not an easy ring to win, it may have been the hardest ring to win.
I want my damn respect, too.
They're the champs. Better give them their damn respect.
Oh! Email.
Can't be the GOAT if you have people cut your steak for you. We've never confirmed that.
Not that me!
Frank Vogel. How about a little respect?
Coach Vogel wanted his respect.
Yeah, I mean, it really isn't what drives me, but there is a little bit of an element of fuel when anybody doubts you as a competitor. Everybody finds ways to put a chip on their shoulder to carry an edge in this competitive environment. I would say it's no different with me.
Chris Mannix.
Like, I don't want to hear it from Laker fans that this was inevitable.
Inevitable.
Please. Where were these Laker fans back in February when Darren Collison was being courted like the girl you couldn't get in high school?
There you are.
And he's hurt. Dak Prescott's hurt. I didn't like the
like
way
saying something
fell.
Sucks is not a take, but I'm going to be saying the word sucks a lot right now because that injury sucks. Like, I don't care if you're a Cowboys fan or not. The injury sucks.
This is your worst nightmare.
Touchdown! Jackpot, baby! Jackpot! Vegas leads it!
Derek Carr was out playing Patrick Mahomes.
Mahomes?
Speed still kills.
We beat you, Tyree.
And they're back to being vertical.
He's too fast.
Darius Butler.
Brown's team, I mean, they're 4-1. Like, nobody. I don't think anyone saw them being 4-1.
I did.
You called it?
Dude, I've been calling them America's team now for a couple of years. I love these guys.
It's looking good all around. They're right up in that mix for that division.
Can you win the game in the first quarter? No!
It's really not true. Like, you can win a game in the first quarter, right? You can win the game in the second quarter, right? You can win the game in the third quarter, too.
Compounding that, you're expecting Chappie to get 7 outs. I absolutely refuse to
Woody,
get my captain.
Shark! Get out of the water, Woody! Woody!
Going at a railroad crossing.
Don't be tempted
lives
to try
this. Lives have been saved, Rick.
Hits the upright. No good.
Oh, my goodness.
Inglewood. Burbank. Woodland Hills. Alhambra. React to me. John Carney would have split the freaking upright. I don't have much time left. This ticker can't take much more of this. Man, I'm pissed.
Talk about Mapletron.
You're talking to Brian Kelly.
You know, nobody knew who Chase Claypool was, and we thought that he was going to make an impact. He's well prepared for the success that he's going to get in the NFL.
Twitter.
You see Chris Berman last night? He said, thank God for Clayton Kershaw's back. Eli Drinkwitz is my guest.
Are you going to prepare for that opportunity, or are you going to BCD?
BCD. What does that mean?
Blame, complain, and defend. Blame poor performance. You complain about breaks just didn't go your way, or you defend. Hey, we just don't do that.
I cannot help you unless you give me your cell phone number.
So I'll take that under consideration, Alicia.
Okay, I'm waiting.
Good, Alicia. I'll let you know when I'm ready.
Which is never.
Come in against Derrick Henry. You better go low.
They got bullied by a bigger bully. You better hope that was just one bad night, Bills Mafia, because that was one gigantic step backwards.
Holy crap.
Jeffrey Chadiha.
That's stiff arm. I haven't seen something like that since I was watching Patrick Swayze back in Roadhouse.
Roadhouse.
Manhandling people back in those days.
Take out the trash.
And Thomas, man, how long are you going to make me wait before you find me and wish me a happy birthday? I wish you a happy birthday every year, old man, on this day.
This is the Garrett Ranton Show on CBS.
Damn right it is, gang. What is going on, clones? And Tom Hanks went belly up as well. So bring it on. Freaking ridiculous, right? Talk to me.
Hi, Garrett.
Oh, Andy, how are you?
I can listen to you all day. You're doing a great job.
I see. Ambi. So my hard tickets are looking pretty puny right about now. Uh-oh. I'll have my people talk to your people.
John in C-Town. Brother, is that you?
What is up, fam? Smack, happy
my
birthday,
man.
Buddy. To me, the jungle's more than just a radio show. It's a way of life. What is up, these Smack? What is up, these Smack?
The law of the farm has never changed. You still have to plow. Your roots determine your fruit.
Steve, great to have you on. Thanks so much. Good luck. Good to talk to you.
That's right.
Her mouth is agape, exposing her beaver-like chompers, while her beady black eyes are riveted on the ball. Richard Jefferson.
It's all about how hard you work and continuing to grind. I saw you fly out to do a CBS football. The people that survive in this industry are the ones that are constantly working and putting in the time and the effort.
Give me my time, baby.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me on. Take care.
It's the takeover.
Grow a pair and then tell her I'm not watching a girly show.
So-and-so messed up.
Back. Girth Brooks performing on Pornhub.
Jimmy.
Let's go, man. Let's finish strong.
With my rocket, Rome.
Alvin, turn me on.
Uh-oh.
That's Rick. Finding the dog sound.
At least you didn't kill Teddy Bridgewater like you did Tom Hanks.
Good night now!
My deck is in there. Good job, Alvin. Funny stuff.
Good night!